think, you know, went really well. Well,
yeah.
So what was your favorite announcement from yesterday? You're on the .NET team, so you're slightly biased.
Yeah, well, .NET Core 1.1 release.
1.1.
One of my favorite things about it. We're really branching out. It works on Linux Mint 18 now.
Oh, awesome.
So we're kind of
expanding
going
support,
into, yeah,
releases.
We care about our That's Linux awesome. Users. Really cool.
Yeah, Linux. It's all about Linux nowadays. We love it. And also, we had Tizen announcement. I think that was really cool. The fact that, you know, not only did we announce that .NET Core is going to run there, we got Samsung and Google mm-hmm. joining the foundation,
yes.
right?
The .NET Foundation.
Yeah,
pretty
it's
cool.
Like, it's going to be one busy company.
It's a new
there.
World. Yeah,
it's a whole new world. Well, we also had a Tech and Power survey come out, and they seem to like our performance compared
did well.
To everybody else. It's awesome. There's actually an aka.ms link. You folks can go to aka.ms/Tech and Power. There's a really good kind of performance summary overview, and Scott even mentioned in his video. So we've got a great panel today. Let's mm-hmm. kick it off.
Yeah.
Right, let's break it to them.
Hey, welcome, guys. So you guys are ready for the .NET Natural Languages? Oh, sorry about that. I'm Karen Ng, and I'm the Chief Staff for the Developer Tools and Services Division, and I'm here with some great guys. You guys want to give an intro to yourself?
Sure. My name is Emil Danforth. I'm a PM on the .NET team.
Mm-hmm. What do you do?
What I do, well, I work on the .NET team, so everything open source related, the BCL, you know, I'm over the place. Like .NET Standard is probably the most commonly known one at this point.
Okay, awesome. David?
David Felder, I'm an architect on the ASP.NET Core team. I work on pretty much everything on ASP.NET, design, go to meetings, and write code too.
So like those Tech and Power results?
Oh yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
We're gonna get back to that.
It's not all me, but yeah.
Rowan?
I'm Rowan Miller. I work as a program manager on the Entity Framework team here. So I just make sure the trains run on time for EF and do technical design and occasionally get to touch code when I have a spare minute.
Awesome. Ned?
And I'm Matt Storgerson, and I'm a PM on the team that makes C-sharp, Visual Basic, and F-sharp. In particular, I dabble in language design, designing C-sharp, and always making sure that there are new features around the corner.
Awesome. So we heard a little bit from Dimitri and Kendra, like what their favorite announcements were, but what about you guys? What did you guys get really excited about yesterday?
Tech and Power, definitely. That's my big one.
That was big. I want to just say a different one. Visual Studio for Mac, incredible. I think that's, yeah, awesome.
Yeah, it's been a long time, right?
It's a game changer.
Yeah, I think for me it was seeing the cross-platform .NET Everywhere vision really start to come to fruition.
Yeah, in my case, Google joining the foundation is awesome. Working with these people will be probably a lot of fun. We already know two of them, right? Chris Sells and John Skeet. They're pretty known already in the community, so mm-hmm. I'm kind of excited mm-hmm. to talk to them more.
How often will you get to work with them?
Well, I think the foundation has a regular meeting that's like every 2 weeks. But I guess, like, you know, open source, like, we will talk on Twitter more often anyway. So I think it will be as often as it needs to be, right? Yeah.
So yesterday was also the release of .NET Core 1.1.
Right.
Tell me a little bit about that.
So .NET Core 1.1 is basically, we shipped, I don't know when we shipped 1.0, it's already like a blast, but like we basically turned the crank on a bunch of stuff. I mean, the blog post basically highlights the major things. Performance is a key one. We also added a few APIs. I think it totals to like 1,300 APIs, but it's basically all over the place, so we have minor advancements everywhere. We also shipped previews of tooling again, and so you can actually play with this stuff more. There's a bunch of stuff that was happening. I mean, the blog post basically goes through the whole list, so if you're curious, there's always something that everybody likes. My favorite feature is probably in the API space, the ability to read portable PDBs. If you never heard of them, they're kind of awesome, and they have like amazing features that will make debugging much easier, especially in cross-plat.
Cool. So I kind of heard you say the preview of the tooling, but I know .NET Core went, kind of GA. So how do I think about the two? Like, what tools do I use?
Yeah, what we have so far is we have RTM, essentially .NET Core, as the runtime and the framework layer, so they're ready for production, essentially. What we have today is we have preview tooling in Visual Studio 2015 that allows you to use basically .NET Core, target .NET Core. So you have the templates in Visual Studio, you have the project types, mm-hmm. you have the ability to debug. But that tooling for .NET Core is still preview. And we expect to have the RTM level quality with the upcoming version of Visual Studio, which is now called Visual Studio 2017. And so the tooling is still in preview. And there's a bunch of changes that were also announced. Like, for example, we move away from project.json and use MS Build Everywhere. And there are already like demos that you can watch. It's basically still the goal that we had with the original tooling was to make Crossplate really amazing, make console apps really amazing that you can just move on the command line, have a small text file you can edit. And we preserve this even when we move to MS Build. So we make the XML much, much slimmer, and we will preserve that. And so if you want to get a flavor of that, you have to install the preview of Visual Studio 2017, which has basically that tooling. If you want to play with the current bits and you want to deploy to production, we still recommend to use the preview tooling in Visual Studio 2015 because it's still much more mature than what we have in 2017.
Cool, that's good to know. And Rowan, you build Entity Framework, so you guys build on top of .NET Core.
Yeah, we do. So we, at the same time that .NET Core shipped 1.1, we also shipped Entity Framework Core 1.1. And so we've kind of been along for the wild ride as we've worked out what .NET Core is and we've worked out how the tooling works. And so we're also in the same boat. We have tooling that works fairly stably in VS 2015, and if you want to be on the bleeding edge, then you can opt into VS 2017 RC and try out the new world.
Got it. Yeah. We're actually getting the same kind of questions, so it's exciting. So George and Lionel both asked the same thing. So when can we expect .NET Core support for ARM in Linux or for even Raspberry Pi?
It's probably an IMO question.
Yeah, I'm actually not sure what our timeline is for ARM Linux. That one I'm not an expert on. So
I've seen a bunch of things checked in into .NET Core on ASP.NET Core for IoT stuff for ARM, but there's no timeline right now as to when it goes live. It's mostly like just currently in dev and stuff.
Okay, cool. So Mads, I promised to ask you what your favorite children was, although you can't have favorites, right? So what's your favorite C# 7 language feature?
Oh, I love them all equally. the one I think that will change most people's code the most is probably tuples, closely followed by pattern matching, the thing I love about them both is that they sort of introduce new concepts to C#, especially pattern matching. It's like a whole new thing, kind of thing that is the germ of something that can evolve over multiple releases of C# and really become central to how people code. So that's kind of exciting. That's opening a new chapter. If
you will. Awesome. Is there something you can show us?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, awesome. Why don't you go get ready?
Sure.
Show us a couple of things. And David, those Tech Empower results, those were impressive. I was reading that article and it was pretty impressive.
It was great, yeah. I think we spent the last like 3 years doing ASP.NET Core, uh-huh. Even before it was cross-platform. And one day, Damien Edgar was at his table sitting down and he went like this and said, "Why do we suck?" And I think I was there and I kind of said, "Because we don't care." And
you guys weren't even on the map, right?
Yeah, it wasn't because we didn't care. It was because people would always say, you know, going that fast is impossible. Like, who cares? It's not realistic. But the whole point is that it kind of gave us a reason to drive to that performance. So it was a culture change for our team. It was a big thing that we did, where we had everyone caring about allocations, caring about performance. We had a rig called the Smurf Lab that had a bunch of hardware set up to do perf testing. So every day we'd have, you know, some new change. A dev would go on the Smurf Lab, would go check in his code, run some stuff, and then we'd go, "Oh, we got 10 more requests per second." And then we'd have like a count that was like, "Today we got 5%, tomorrow we got 10%. And then we had this like graph of us going from like a couple hundred RPS to 1.1 million.
Awesome.
And then we had Ben Adams, who is a guy from the community who appeared out of nowhere pretty much. And he started using ASP.NET Core and he loves performance. So he just began to like send tons of PRs to Kestrel, our web server. And we ended up having like really good performance out of that whole thing.
Yeah. So you mentioned someone from the community. So ASP.NET Core is all open source?
All open source. The entire thing is open source.
How does it feel on the team when you're kind of working open source?
It is both amazing and awesome at the same time. So you get the constant feedback that you kind of want and don't want sometimes.
Yeah.
At the same time, we get great like contributions from people that are just interested in coding, so we get like great feedback from people.
Got it. How you doing, Mads?
I'm doing great.
You ready?
I'm ready over here.
Okay, we'll switch over and then we'll follow up a little bit with more time.
All right, so we talked about tuples in C#, so I figured I'd show some C# code here. That's VB. So I just wanted to show that even though we talk about C# a lot, Visual Basic also has tuples. So you see here, a function in Visual Basic that is returning a tuple type here and creating a new tuple with a tuple literal here and accessing, tuples have names in C# and Visual Basic, so it's accessing the members of the tuple with names here inside, calling a function, getting the tuple back and dotting into the result of the tuple here in the where it consumes the tuple. So Visual Basic is totally there with tuples as well. But C# has a few more tricks up its sleeve. Let's talk a little bit about pattern matching. So here I have some perfectly valid C# 6 code. It's stupid, but valid. I'm taking in an object. I check that it's not null. I check that it's a point. Otherwise, I'm throwing an exception. I throw a fit here. But if it is a point, I have to then check that it's a point once again to grab it as a point and then start consuming it. So C# 7 makes this easier with patterns. We can, in is expressions, as well as other places, you can now use patterns instead of just types. So I can say, instead of saying O is point, I can say O is point P. As I'm checking its type anyway, I'm grabbing it into a variable, naming it P, and now P is just in scope for the rest of the method to use. So I can just completely delete this line here and just start consuming the P as I grabbed it out here. So this is an example of what we call a type pattern. We also have a simple kind of pattern just called a constant pattern. So I can actually go and check with this expression that O is the constant null here. So I can do my null check like that. All right, so in kind of a similar vein, you see the new kind of suggestion syntax vaguely here. It wants me to do something about this. So let's see, let's press Control Dot and ask the light bulb, what is it that you want me to do with the X and Y here that I'm passing as out parameters? Well, it's saying that I can inline them. So let's try to do that. And what it's doing is it's inlining the declaration of X in the directly here with the out parameters. You can now also declare variables as you pass an out parameter. We call it, surprisingly, out variables. So that's another cool thing we can do. Let's do it with Y as well. And again, another line of code disappeared. Now, actually using out parameters here is kind of outdated now that we have tuples. So I have another overload of the get coordinates method that doesn't take out parameters, but instead returns a tuple. So just like you saw in Visual Basic, I could go and say var t equals and get that tuple back. But C# also has deconstruction. So when I get a tuple, I can actually immediately deconstruct it into two variables, one for each element of the tuple that comes back. So I can instead say var x, y here, get two variables, an x and a y, for the two coordinates that this returns. Right? The tuple immediately gets splatted out into its components, so to speak. But not only that, not only tuples can be deconstructed, but other types can be declared to be deconstructed as well. So if you go here and look at the options I have for completion here, you see that P actually has a deconstruct method, and the C# 7 compiler will recognize when you have a deconstruct method, and it will take that to mean that the type itself can be deconstructed. What does that mean? It means I can just take P itself, the point itself, and deconstruct it into its parts. Okay, well, that's pretty cool. I think it's pretty cool.
That's cool.
Do you want to also take a quick look inside of the point class? There's no C# version without a new point class demo. And one thing I want to just call out here, it's more like style things, maybe. You see the get coordinates method that we used before. It's, of course, an expression body function. We have those since C# 6. But if you look at the other one here, the one with the out parameters, you see that it's also expression bodied. And the one expression it has as its body is an assignment of a tuple to a deconstruction. So you can actually use this pattern to have multiple assignments happen with one assignment. So I'm assigning capital Y to lowercase y here and capital X to lowercase x all in one assignment. That's kind of a cool pattern, I think, when you have a bunch of data that belongs together and you're sort of just assigning it as a block. And also, one thing to point out is that more things can now be expression body members, including constructors in C# 7. So the constructor here is also just I just wrote that within here. So that was a quick tour.
Well, as you were typing, too, I noticed some fancy IDE things going on. So
yeah.
Casey showed off that new IntelliSense yesterday. Can you show us a little bit there?
We can try. So let's go back up to where we have some dots going. Well, I kind of took all my dots away, didn't I? Let's add one. I probably can't show it right now because I haven't turned it on. What you can do if you have it turned on is to filter on the different member kinds. I should have turned that on for the demo, okay. But you can filter on the different member kinds And you can also get highlighted if you type something for a completion. Like I type GC here to get coordinates, and you can see that here actually. Oh, it actually works. You can see that G and C are highlighted to show what's the thing that I was typing, where does it occur in the member name. Oh, and here we actually have the filtering. If I look for, I don't have very many things called that, but if I look for different members here, I can filter on which kind they are and get only those lists. All right? I noticed that Karen is being re-mic'd up, so you're kind of quiet.
It's always my hair that gets in the way. Oh.
I don't have that problem. My beard sometimes.
Yes. Okay, thanks, Mads. Yeah, it's great. IntelliSense has changed to what bit since I worked on it?
Yeah, it becomes smarter and smarter. It knows more and more about what you're doing, and I think that it adds hugely to productivity. IntelliSense, as well as refactoring, is super reliable now and very good at knowing what you want to do. And so not only do you have these productive tools in your hands, but you're able to trust them, especially since Roslyn. And with more and more refactorings coming in, you saw the one that I made use of, more and more refactorings are coming into Visual Studio in the box now. And they're just rock solid, like they will do exactly what you expect. And so people can start to trust them and use them in their daily work.
That's awesome. And it's all because of Roslyn?
It's all because of Roslyn, yes. Everything good is all because of Roslyn.
Thanks, Roslyn.
He has to say that, right? So we have a couple questions that are coming in. So from Ben, when will any new framework core support 1N mappings and NM mapping?
So I think what the question is asking is about how, when you define relationships between entities, uh-huh. At the moment, EF doesn't support many-to-many relationships, which is the idea I have like a post class and a tag class and have collections that point to each other. Post has many tags, a tag has many posts. So EF doesn't natively support that at the moment, at least EF core doesn't. But what we do support is if you have an entity that represents the join. So you can have a post tags class in .NET and you effectively have two one-to-many relationships. So when we talk about many-to-many mapping, at the high level, the pattern is supported. What people often want is the ability to not have a join class in their model. So that when they reason about a post having tags, they don't have to think about there being a join table in the database.
Got it.
So that is something that we want to add in the future, but it doesn't prevent you from implementing many-to-many mappings at the moment. We just want to clean it up a bit so that your domain model and your .NET classes can be a bit more flexible in how they're defined.
Got it. Yep. And Rowan, do you want to show us something today, too?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, why don't you get set up and we'll talk a little bit more. Let's go back to Tech Compower a little bit. So,
yeah.
David, we're talking about those results. You know, team. I love hearing that the team kind of went to culture change because yep. I think making those kind of really dramatic performance improvements, it is a culture shift.
Yeah.
Like it's about what you value and how you kind of go for that.
Yeah, it was big because I think there's a joke in our team though. Whenever someone says don't, someone says allocate in the same room. Like don't allocate, like as a joke, but it's kind of it kind of shows the change in cultures in general. So devs are more aware of like allocating memory as they use it, and people are aware in code reviews that things are going on. So it's kind of made the entire team aware of like you know the performance in .NET in general, mm-hmm. and it's been good for the team in general, I think. And it spanned more than just our team; it was our team and .NET team. So we mm-hmm. we kind of worked together to make the entire stack faster.
Awesome. Tell me about what you guys did with the allocation. How did you make
One huge thing we did to make it a lot faster was whenever you're trying to figure out if, so HTTP works, right? You get bytes from the internet, right. They come in off the wire, you parse bytes, and you turn them into strings for headers, right? So headers, there's like content length, there's a bunch of known headers. Instead of having a dictionary from string to string, which are the names of headers, you can have a class that kind of backs the dictionary that has a bunch of fields for known headers. So instead of having a dictionary entry and a hash lookup for every single key, for the known ones, we kind of hard code, you know, here are the 25 known things that Chrome sends, and we can bake those into the system and not have them be a lookup for a dictionary lookup. So you kind of have, you avoid the whole lookup and hashing, you just have a single field for every header that's known. And that was a huge perf win. We also don't allocate to compare strings. So imagine you have a bunch of bytes on the wire that map to content length. We can actually do a comparison by generating code that kind of does the string comparison ahead of time. So we can say, given these bytes, is that content length? If it is, then don't allocate a string, but compare it in place, and then have the string content length be a constant that's used for all requests. So we cache like strings, we cache bytes, we cache known things, we pool memory, we pool bytes for the server. So as you have one connection that has multiple requests. We can reuse buffers that were processed and handled already.
Awesome.
So yeah.
That's really cool.
The other thing I want to point out is because we always talk about the community, but the one thing that open source has done, I mean, ASP.NET is open source for much longer than the rest of the stack was, but you know that basically the entire stack is open source, right, from the runtime to the framework to ASP.NET. People like Ben Adams, they basically just look at what they do and they look at, okay, where am I losing performance? And so, for example, Ben Adams recently submitted a PR that changes our threading primitives because the locking took too long. And so they found a way to make that smarter and faster. So the nice thing is, not only do we have a community outside, it also the community helps us to tie the teams on the other end more together by basically forcing PRs that span multiple layers and basically do these, you know, cross-cutting optimizations that no matter what organization setup you have, you always have some organizational thinking where you only look at your own layers to a certain extent, and that helps glue the whole thing together and say, no, I want to really have a great performance from the request all the way down to the networking stack to the runtime, the GC, and many other things.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I didn't really think of open source that way, but I mean, really, they don't know, nobody knows our organization structure.
Right.
You're really thinking about the whole project at once.
I think what tends to happen is when you're working on a thing for so long, you kind of get blinders. So you see your code and you know how it works. So then someone like Ben comes in and says, oh, you can do it like four different ways. And then you go, you're right. Send a PR. And then he like sends four PRs. And then we're like, oh, okay, that one's good. Let me merge it. And then we're like, oh my gosh, we didn't know we could do this without having to, you know, think about the whole thing.
That's cool. Mads, is that the same? So I mean, language design, man, I remember the days where we had the closed meetings. You know, Monday, Wednesday, Fridays. How is language design on?
There was a time when this kind of event would be where we announced new language features.
Right.
We don't announce anything anymore because it's all created in the open, and everybody who wants to follow can do so, even though it's probably confusing and time consuming to do it. So the openness means that everyone can participate from day one, and it's been made a huge difference to how we innovate. It becomes much more of a conversation immediately with the people who are eventually going to use the feature. We get tons of early course correction when we design a feature. Even deciding which things to do is influenced very early on. Like, this probably isn't going to fly because of this and this. We could do it like that. These people proposed this and that. And when we get to the finishing touches, we use that feedback loop all the time. Right. We still make the final calls in a language design meeting setting. That's still a physical meeting, even though some people call in. And I think it's important to also have that creative process and to have a body that is kind of making sure that it all comes together and feels unified. But having that conversation with the community has really been a game changer.
That's awesome.
It's wonderful.
Okay, so before we move to Rowan, I want to ask you one thing. Roland just asked, is there a plan to bring immutables into C Sharp?
It's not a plan, but it's something that the immutable pattern, if you will, or being able to work with types knowing, or work with data knowing that it won't change under your feet, is very important. And it's something that actually the whole Roslyn API itself is designed around immutability, and it gives it a lot of both its resilience and its performance characteristics. And so it is becoming increasingly useful and common to use immutability. And so we are constantly looking for what are the next steps we can take to bring immutability into the language as more of a first class thing. It's not something we have concrete plans for yet, but I think you will see us gradually make that more of an even playing field between mutable and immutable.
Awesome. Thanks for the question, Roland. Okay, let's go over to Rowan.
All right, thanks. So I want to demo just one of the features that we released in EF Core 1.1. So this is the ability to do mapping to fields, which sounds like a trivial little feature, but what it actually does is it opens up a whole bunch of possibilities about the shape of the .NET classes that you define and then map to the database. So if we swap to my screen, what I've got here is a very basic EF Core model. I've defined a context. This represents a session with the database and allows me to query and save data. And I have a DB set for the one entity type in my model. It's a blog. I've wired this up to use SQL Server, and it's pulling a connection string from the config file. That connection string points to a blogging database on my local DB instance. So if we swap over, you'll see the blogging database here. And if I look in the blog table, you'll see that I have some existing data in the database. And you'll also notice that a blog has an ID, a name, and a URL as well. So let's swap back to Visual Studio. Typically, Entity Framework classes in the past have always had properties like blog ID and name here that have getters and setters. And this is actually quite restrictive. It's easy, but it limits the amount of flexibility you have to define the shape of your .NET classes. So the other thing that blog has is the URL property is a read-only property. It just has a getter, but no setter. The data is stored in a private field called validated URL. And when I set it, I actually do some work. I go off and I spin off an HTTP request to make sure the URL that I've got is valid. And this is the type of logic that you really wouldn't want to put in a property setter. Okay, so we've split that off into a method. Now, the problem is EF at the moment is completely ignoring the URL property because by default, EF will only map properties that have both a getter and a setter. So we're going to look at using the field support we introduced in 1.1 to work with the URL data. So in my on model creating, which is where I kind of extend the model to supplement what was discovered by convention, I'm going to pull up the configuration for the blog entity. I'm then going to drill into the URL property. And then I'm going to make use of the new hasField method, which takes a string for the field name. And I'm just going to copy the field name that we have here. So at this point, I've told EF that there's a property called URL. It's not going to be able to set the data using that property. So I've told it that there's a backing field called underscore validated URL that EF can use when it can't use the property. This is a console app. So if we scroll up, you'll see I'm running a simple link query against the database to get all blogs ordered by name. And then I'm looping through and writing out the name and the URL to the console. Let's just run this. We'll see that EF is successfully pulling back the URL data from the database and setting it into the field. Now, by default, when we set this up, EF is going to use the property when it can. So when it's getting the data, it's going to use the property. And it's going to use the field when it needs to. So when it needs to set the data, in our case, it's going to use the field. But I can actually override that as well. I can say use property access mode. And I could say field. And this would mean that EF would always use the field. So it's going to ignore the fact that the property is there. That doesn't really matter for our demo, so we'll leave that out. Let's go one step further. Let's say that I don't want to have any properties at all. Let's change URL property to be a getURL method. And we'll just tidy the implementation up a little bit, seeing as it's not a property. And so at this point, I can no longer write this line of code that I had in onModel creating because there is no property to map to. I have two options here. I could just write this, and EF is smart enough to say, if I can't find a property with that name, I'll go and find a field and use that instead. But that's a little bit messy because we end up with a property in our model called underscore validated URL, which means that's what it's going to look for in the database in terms of columns. It's what's going to show in any metadata that I load up. So that's a little bit messy. So let's do something better. What we're going to do is introduce kind of a conceptual property into the model. So this is a property that doesn't exist in my CLR class. Mm-hmm. But it does exist in the metadata that EF has. So I'm saying there's a string property called URL that is backed by that field. Now, the one change we need to make here is we can no longer call the URL property. So we're going to swap to getURL instead. And then we'll run. We'll see that data is coming back. And now EF is just pumping data in and out of that field. And we're able to use the get and set methods in our application. One other thing that we introduced is the ability to actually refer to those properties that are conceptually part of the model in a link query. So at the moment, I could write order by getURL, but the problem is that EF has no idea how to translate that into a query in the database. That's a feature we'd love to add in the future, but at the moment, we don't support telling us how to translate .NET methods into database SQL. And so in that case, we can go EF.property. And we can say on blog, there's a URL property, like so. So we're saying order by that URL property that is conceptually part of the model. We'll run this again, and we'll see that this time we get data ordered by URL. And if I swap to SQL profile that I have running in the background, we'll see that the order by is getting pushed to the database.
Awesome. Thanks, Ron. Oh, we had a question come in. Mm-hmm. How does Entity Framework implement polymorphic associations, like for Ruby on Rails or Hibernate?
So we don't really support that at the moment. This feature that I just demoed is all about, there's kind of a spectrum of flexibility. So EF6 and the first version of EF Core were very rigid about the shape of your .NET classes and how they're defined. And there's obviously a huge spectrum where you could have any shape of classes. The ability to support backing fields was a little step towards being more flexible. And then the ideas of polymorphic associations, and then having things like property bags on your entities instead of properties and methods, those things kind of work down that spectrum of being more and more flexible. So that's the kind of direction that we're heading with future releases of EF Core.
Cool. Thanks, Ron.
Cool.
Ooh, which one do we want to take next? Well, let's do performance GC performance improvements. So one of the questions we have, it's probably for you, Mo. Any new GC performance improvements to look forward to?
I'm not aware of like any massive changes we're doing right now, but if you go to our repository for the future, we're working on a new feature which we call span of T, which is basic representation for you know, think of byte arrays or pointers in memory and giving you a managed representation for that. And that allows us to do smart things like saying you have an array and you want to take a subset of that array.
Yeah.
In order to make that work, the GC has to be able to track those pointers efficiently. So that's not necessarily a feature that makes the garbage collection itself better, but it basically allows the type system to do things that it can't do today. And if you go to our core repository right now, you can actually see the feature being done in real time. But I think in 1.1 we don't have any major GC changes.
Yeah, I think time was spent making the GC on Linux the same performance as Windows. So I think that was the bulk of the work for 1.1, 1.x.
Got it. What do you mean, like making it the same performance as so, like for Windows 10?
So before we had the GC, it was all Windows.
Yeah.
It probably used a bunch of Windows specific features.
I see. So I think cross-platform.
Yeah. Cross-platform and having the same parity for performance for server GC, client GC was kind of the big things to make it work. Yeah.
Yeah.
I did have one thing on the EF side, so it didn't actually make it into 1.1. But if you look on GitHub, we've been doing some work around limiting the amount of GC that needs to be done in EF.
Right.
So that's another way to look at performance too. So typically, with an ASP.NET application, you would create an instance of a context, which then has a whole bunch of stuff that it depends on. And so obviously, all that stuff needs to be cleaned up at the end of a request.
Right.
So we've been working on a feature called context pooling, similar to connection pooling, where we create this whole structure of stuff, we use it for a request, and then we clean it up and put it back on the pool. So that stuff doesn't need to be GC'd or reallocated when the next request comes in. So okay, that's cool. Just an example of some of the perf stuff we're doing in EF as well.
Okay, so we have a hot question come in. You know, it was on Reddit, top of Reddit for quite a while, had a bunch of community asks about it, but .NET Core, so going away from Project JSON and moving to MS Build, why do we do that? What's your perspective? You guys can be.
Well, I mean, if you look at the whole thing, right? When we started .NET Core, it was very clearly going after Crossplat, right?
Yeah.
On the Windows side, it was, well, really, if you want to use Windows, what you have to do is you kind of have to basically use Visual Studio, use the somewhat heavyweight infrastructure that we have, and then it generates some files like the project files on the side, and you don't really want to look at them. I mean, they're XML files, they're designed to be generated by the tools,
right.
But they're not necessarily super awesome to look at. But if you want to work, let's say, on a Linux machine where you have, let's say, VI, because you're in a terminal environment, well, if you have like a 300-line project file that has very lengthy names, that's not the best environment. So we wanted to have something that is way more focused on the command line, way more focused on being basically hackable text that is easy to edit. And that's why David came up with project.json, because it turns out JSON is really popular outside the Microsoft ecosystem when it comes to project definitions itself. But when we actually try to tie this whole thing together to the rest of Visual Studio, when you create class libraries using project.json, and you want to reference those class libraries to some other projects that are still MS Build based, that there was so much loss of translation involved. And then if you now look at Xamarin has done a bunch of work on their side to support iOS and Android development, let's say on a Mac, and they were also MS Build based. And so we needed to tie this whole ecosystem to something where we can say, okay, we have one way to build class libraries. And if you look at .NET Standard, there's really the idea that we have a unified class library that every application can reference. And it's important if you think about how projects work when, you know, you build a project, you reference that project, the project and its transitive closure of artifacts have to be copied to the output folder. There's a bunch of smartness runs in the tools that have to understand your dependencies. And if you mismatch in the tooling, it's really hard to glue this back together. And so we said, okay, we have 89 projects that are like all MS Build based. We have three that are project.json based. Should we teach the rest of project.json? Should we teach the remaining three about MS Build?
Mm, got it.
And so we said, okay, let's move to MS Build.
One of the things I love about project.json format, though, is just how easy it is to edit.
Right.
So how do you guys think about that?
I mean, we already showed it yesterday, a bunch of demos where you see a preview of where we're heading. The general idea is take this 300-line XML file and remove as much of the noise as you can. So the biggest bang for the buck you see probably is wildcard inclusions. So you don't want to list every single file individually and just say star.cs, which you can already do today, but in 2015. But the biggest problem is as soon as you mess with the files, VS will expand the list again, and then you're losing this whole benefit. And the second thing we do is we do like major, you know, syntactic changes to MS Builder, so I should say minor, like things like we move the namespace, for example, add some syntactic sugar where you can move things to attributes to make it a bit more condensed, remove some of the goo that essentially is only relevant for VS, and we basically persisted it by accident, not really by design.
No more GUIDs.
No more GUIDs. Everybody loves GUIDs, right? They're so easy to review.
Project ID 572-403-7624.
I think it is.
Project format.
Curly brace.
And so, like, yeah, if you look at the GitHub project for the project system, you can already see previews, like, syntactically, what we think we will be heading. So I think most project will probably be in the realm of 25 to like 30 lines.
A single page.
Okay, that's good. Well, I mean, Rowan, I mean, your Entity Framework kind of builds on top. So you kind you were along for the ride.
Yeah, so we've been along for the whole ride of .NET and .NET Core and all the tooling and everything we're doing, which has been crazy at times. But we're actually, so we've talked MS Build, I guess everything that Imo just said. So we kind of had two systems, right? Yeah. We had XProj, Project JSON, and then we have CSProj and MS Build. And for us, for our tooling is actually quite smart. When we do things like migrations, we need to actually build your project and get the output artifacts and load them up and actually run code. And so we actually interact a lot with your project. We had two implementations in the past. We had one that worked with Project JSON and XProj that was, you know, we'd spent a year working on it, but it was still full of bugs and it still had a lot of issues and it did not have parity with the other ones. As we've swapped to the .NET Core tooling on MS Build, we've done a few tweaks to the existing commands we have, and they actually work. And they've fixed a lot of the issues that we had that we were trying to solve on XProj and Project JSON. So I think we're actually seeing the fruition is that tooling and things like that, the reason about the project system, it's a lot easier to move them across to .NET Core now rather than having to reason about a whole new and understand a whole new project system.
Yeah, makes sense. So .NET, Entity Framework, open source, cross-plat, it's been a really big change in the last few years. How does, like, what's the culture like on the teams now that you have to think about every platform?
I would say in general, our teams, I feel like we're a lot more flexible. We interact a lot more too. I was actually, it was interesting when you guys were talking about how with performance, it's easier for the external community to come and interact with us and look at our whole stack. That's actually easier across teams as well now too. Yeah. So we're looking at debugging an ASP.NET Core problem where it's not performing like we want on Linux and the bottleneck ends up being an EF. It's much easier for an EF dev to like walk across and understand the ASP.NET code base and look at the checked in benchmarks and run them on their machine. It's just a lot easier and more agile to work.
You know what's funny and sad? So
yes, David.
I could clone the CLR, make a change, test it easier on GitHub than I could when it was internal.
Yeah.
Like, it is so easy now. The barrier is so low. I can go on, like, before I go to bed, like, read a book, I can, like, go to Roslyn and, like, surf some code and, like, read some code in Roslyn. Before, like, internally, it was actually a lot of process. The right permissions, the right stuff, the right enlistments, find the right, like, instructions. And now it's just Git clone, bam, I can, like, so, oh, Roslyn, you have a bug here. PR. Like, mad, just fix it. Merge it. And it's super nice now.
Do you guys find you talk to each other? Like, is this the first time you're seeing each other in person?
I keep trying to remember who.
I don't even know who there. I've never seen them before.
So the one thing that we do definitely see is that if you consider open source not as a side effect, but something you actively do,
when you do outreach
and you try to standardize your tooling, it's something that internally never happened, right? I mean, internally you don't. I mean, there were some organizations that tried to standardize their tooling, but even within the developer division, which is basically one giant team, it was not as smooth as it could have been. And now that we actually think about, okay, how would a person who has never approached their code base be able to clone, change, and do a PR in, let's say, under an hour? That makes everybody's life easier, right? And on top of that, when you look at open source, I mean, I have a friend, David Keane, who works on the project system. He just moved back to Australia. I think some of the stuff we do now with open source also kind of like helps with working remotely.
Yeah.
And many other companies have already done that, and we are basically doing that as well. And with Xamarin, we have another, you know, big team that we work for on a daily basis that is not within the, Redmond Reality Distortion Field, essentially, right? And I think that's good.
Redmond Distortion Field.
The other thing I would add on open source, it's not just about our code base. So one of the best things about open source for us has been working with database provider writers for EF Core. So some of our main providers, so like SQL Compact
Postgres.
And Postgres, those are open source projects as well. which doesn't just mean that we can help them debug their code. It also means they can push changes easily back into our code. So they will work against our nightly builds when that doesn't work. They work against our code base, they fix the bug in our code, and they send a pull request back to us. And so some of the people that we work closely with, like Shay, who does the Postgres provider,
yeah.
I've actually never met him, but we work together on an almost daily basis on GitHub.
Yeah.
So it's been really cool to see the kind of the back and forth between related open source projects.
Yeah, it is really cool. I mean, I know that the big Samson and Tizen, you know, .NET on Tizen, one of the big reasons was, you know, because .NET is open source now. Mm-hmm. What do you guys think about that?
To me, like, the most amazing thing that Hanselman said was, if you think about it, pretty much .NET is everywhere, and you can actually see it now. You have it on watches, essentially, you have it on the TV, you have it obviously on the smartphones for a while now. So pretty much any place you can imagine being an app being written for, .NET can kind of go there, or at least there's a path that we can see mm-hmm, ourselves mm-hmm. Going to.
And yeah, with IoT and everything, right?
Yeah.
Like everything's like, going to be.
Yeah, they had tooling and everything. Like I saw the check-ins for ARM and stuff, and I was like, okay. Then I saw like VS support, and I was like, what? You can F5 and it will go on my TV, and like, I can
amazing.
Have my watch. Yeah. It was shocking. I was like, wow.
And one thing that I think is incredibly cool about it is that it's not that .NET is on TVs because Microsoft wanted to put it on TVs. .NET really truly belongs to the community now, right? And somebody decides to put it there and they can go put it there. It's really a new world. That's when you really realize how big a change open source has been for us.
I think the other thing I like about that vision of seeing .NET in so many different places is it's the same .NET everywhere now. It's not different versions. So for me, with Entity Framework Data Access, we're in the process, we're not quite there yet, of having, you can use the same data access stack wherever you are. Now, obviously, the databases that you can talk to vary from platform to platform, but having that same coding experience where my data access when I'm on UWP is not different than when I'm on full.NET. It's the same data access stack everywhere.
Yeah. So that actually brings me back, kind of, we've been talking about .NET Core a bit, .NET everywhere, but .NET Standard. So how do I think about .NET Standard with .NET Core?
Oh, it's amazing. It's awesome.
Yeah.
No, I mean, if you think about it, like Rowan just said it, right? The biggest problem that we have is that we had .NET in multiple places before, and they were all like
different
styles,
versions.
Different flavors, right? And we needed something that glues them all together so that people like Rowan that try to build technology that runs in multiple places, you can do this without doing a PhD in .NET. And so .NET Standard basically is, if you think about it from the base layer, like the things you expect to be everywhere, you know, strings obviously, collections, networking, and a bunch of other stuff that is agnostic to the platform, the application model, that's basically what .NET Standard represents. It's a set of APIs that every .NET platform has to offer to be considered a valid implementation. And then these things have version numbers, so we can build tooling around that. So you can say, I want to run on .NET Standard 2.0, let's say, and then several platforms implement 2.0, so you can run on all the platforms that implement 2.0 or later. So that means for the people that build class libraries, that's basically just one platform to target, and that's .NET Standard. And then all the concrete platforms just happen to implement .NET Standard.
Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and that's actually how EF works across platforms. Today, at the moment, it targets .NET Standard 1.3. So that's how we run everywhere.
Okay, right. Makes sense. We got a question come in from Suman. When will the .NET Standard 2.0 be available with .NET Core?
Yeah, so we will ship .NET Standard 2.0 in the same timeline as Visual Studio 2017 will be shipped.
Okay.
We will probably have a preview of .NET Standard 2.0, meaning like a package for .NET Standard, as well as a package for .NET Core that provides implementation for .NET Standard, probably before that time, and you probably have to be hacking your project types a bit to actually use it.
Okay, so tune into the previews and our, yeah.
Right.
Got it. Let's see. Okay, we'll take Mohammed's question. So I would like to know, if I use object to be returned from method instead of tuple, what is the added value that the tuple presents?
Well, if you use object, which actually some people do when they have multiple results, right?
Yeah.
There's a pattern where you have a you use an anonymous type to create something with members. The compiler generates a type under the hood. But anonymous types are anonymous, so you can't say them in your return type, so you return them as object or as dynamic sometimes. So the downside of that is the receiver doesn't know what's in there except by convention. And they have to kind of dig back out the members in there, typically by using dynamic. So what tuples give you is an easy way to say exactly what's in there, as well as a very efficient runtime representation of it. It's just a struct, and it's not even generated by the compiler. It's a struct type that's already there in the framework. So it gives you the strong typing, it gives you an efficient transfer of those values and gives you super tooling because of those things.
And to me, the biggest value add that the new tuplets provide is the fact that you can name them, right? I mean, we have tuplets in the framework for a while now, like system.tuple is already there, but value tuple is the more efficient representation, but also C# now is a way to name those. So you can, in the API signature, say it's not just an int and an int, you can actually name them and say this is the age and this is the length or whatever. Or the
it's offset. Not item one, item two, yeah, item three, yeah, item four, right. Yeah.
You can use those names if you really like them. They're always there. Those are the names in the underlying type.
Yeah.
But one of the early design decisions with C# tuples, and I think it's proving to be a really good decision, is yes, they will have names, but those names won't actually be baked in at runtime. Right. There's something the compiler tracks to help you use them, but the tuples are predefined types that are already there in the framework. And that means that even if you have tuples with different names, which I had in my VB demo before, right. They're completely compatible. They're the same thing under the hood. The names are just like guardrails for you at the design time, really.
And those names you can see by doing the go to definition and having the generated.
Yeah, well, you can go to the definition of the thing where the tuple comes from.
Oh, our laughing about GUIDs brought a question in, too.
So
Keith asks, how about the solution file format? It is definitely full of GUIDs.
In time.
And nearly impossible to merge. So when's that getting an update?
So the way you merge them, by the way, is you just say resolve as theirs, and then you just manually add the project back. That's how I do it.
Git revert hard, undo the parent changes.
It's a well-known problem. I mean, like one of the problems that MS Build has, I mean, one of the reasons we went with XML, by the way, and not with JSON for the new representation was MS Build already has knowledge about the file formats, right? Whether it's XML or the solution file format. And like changing those is actually really, really hard because there's so many places that know about them. So we would like to change them, it's just we couldn't do it for the upcoming version. And I think eventually everybody I know had to merge at some point in event merge. So it is definitely known. So
sometime in the future, but not yet.
So how has, we talked a little bit about Kestrel Web Server, TechEmpower, performance, GC performance. How has performance really kind of impacted team culture and when we think ahead for what's coming next, how do we think about that?
Well, I mean, from my point of view, like I'm on the team that does the API design, right?
Yeah.
And so if you look at what are the major pivots of API design for .NET, it has always been usability, right? We care about the fact that you can write code, the code looks intuitive and is correct, but we didn't really care about performance. I mean, very simple example, when you call console write line, and you pass in variable number of arguments, we create an array for you that just represents those values, and then they get boxed because they're object. And if you don't call the methods, we just happily create an empty array for you. And we've done some performance optimizations in the past, but really, to me, the cultural shift is to think about performance as a major part of your code,
yeah.
Where code that you write that's intuitive is not only correct, it's also efficient, and you don't waste cycles, right? Because if you think about the cloud, you know, you have to be mindful of people's money because the more inefficient you are, the more runtime overhead you produce. So that's, I think, the major shift on our side.
Yeah, I would say the same thing for EF2, both in API design, just thinking about, okay, so if we do this, what coding patterns are people going to use? How much stuff are we going to be, are we going to be throwing away? The other thing I would add too, historically, at least for EF, and I think for most other teams as well, the performance benchmarking and things like that were done by members that weren't actually working on the product code. And that stuff was very kind of tucked away, kind of a black box to developers. On EF now, we actually have a benchmarks repo that is just one of our source code repos. And developers can easily check in tests that are the same as the unit tests they would write when they're testing product code. We just run them a bunch of times and see how long they take to run. And that shows up and we have benchmarks that we keep to compare. So we, as a baseline for EF Core, we tend to use EF6. So we say, one of our goals with EF Core was to be faster and to use less memory than EF6. So to validate that, we write tests and check them in when we add features. We make sure that we are actually faster, and if we're not, we spend time fixing it. So I think that's one of the big cultures is performance isn't an external thing that gets done, it's just part of our development process.
Yeah, right. That's huge. So for ASP.NET, we actually have a meeting every Friday where we get the EF team, we get our entire team together for performance, and we discuss performance metrics, we discuss benchmarks, we discuss things in blocks that we've seen people compare us to Go or Node, and we talk about those things, and we kind of have a strategy for going forward. So casual is the beginning. And now it turns out, you know, people do more than just write hello world. So we have to make like auth faster and EF faster. Like the pooling came from a test in Technopar called Fortunes, which does an EF query and then does a database, a string format style thing. And it turns out we're really bad at like that combination of stuff. And it's not that you can't be fast, it's that when you do it in the .NET way, it just isn't fast by default. So we kind of have to fix like string builder now, so we have the PRs for .NET Core, and we have to fix EF to do pooling. So those things kind of come out of the entire performance culture.
That's cool. We're doing
it across the stack now.
And that's actually an interesting point, too. We're not just optimizing code paths. We're actually, at some points, introducing new features to allow you to scale, for example, a website. Right. So pooling is something that probably wouldn't be on by default because there's some caveats to using it.
Right. Yeah.
But it's a feature that you can opt into if scale is super important to you.
Actually, scale and Kestrel make me think of the Age of Sunk game. Totally written on.
I think Ben had a video of a GC pause like in space. Like, all the ships disappeared. And it was like an actual GC pause, like visual, and it was like, wow, it's super cool.
It was pretty amazing. Yeah. I kind of remember. It's like that massive real-time game. And so that's all based on Kestrel?
Yeah, no. So before, he wrote his own web server, and he was doing his own thing. And he came here, and we spoke. We had lunch. Uh-huh. And I said, dude, just use Kestrel. And he was like, all right. And then he just like threw stuff away, started helping with Kestrel, and then he uses it now in his game.
That's amazing.
His game.
That's awesome. Rowan, Entity Framework Core for DocumentDB.
So we've actually just started talking with somebody who is interested in writing the DocumentDB and MongoDB providers too. So I would say it's not, there obviously aren't previews or anything you can go look at yet, but we are in discussion. Obviously our team would love to write all of these cool providers to connect to DocumentDB and Azure Table Storage and Redis and all these things that we've kind of architected EF Core to be capable of connecting to. But at the same time, we also have a whole bunch of features we want to go use, go implement in EF Core as well, and you have limited amount of people and limited amount of time. So it's actually super exciting to be working with people outside of our team. Some of them are Microsoft MVPs, some of them don't really have any affiliation with Microsoft at all, some of them are other Microsoft employees that just don't work effectively on the EF team. And so I hope that over the next year or so, we're going to start to see some of these non-relational providers pop up. Hopefully some will come from our team, others will come from outside of our team as well.
Awesome.
Yep.
Oh, CoDOM. So CoDOM compilation as it relates to core and standard.
CoDOM.
What are the thoughts around that?
Well, we recently ported CoDOM to core. Basically, if you think of CoDOM, it does two things. One of them is it just emits a bunch of, it's basically a glorified string formatter, essentially. And then the second part is you can it just invokes the compiler, essentially. And what we have ported to core right now is the formatting part. Because if you have code written against CoDOM, that's the predominant portion of your code. And then we said if you want to compile, you just invoke CSC or MSC, depending on whether you use Mono or .NET Core, and you just compile that. So that's our story, essentially. But I think for most part, if you actually write a real compiler, you shouldn't use CoDOM. You should probably use something like Roslyn. They load the metadata APIs to actually emit the PE files.
OK, we'll take one from Cecil. Can you guys talk about the new system.io.pipelines features?
Yeah, so as part of the whole perf work in ASP.NET Core, Kestrel, figuring out how to make things fast, there's an effort to move that kind of knowledge into the BCL itself, so to have everyone have the same benefits that we learned doing ASP.NET Core. So we want to make new primitives for people that are doing server stuff or networking stuff to have these things on by default. So this is an effort to bring what we learned in ASP.NET Core and Kestrel and Tech Empower to the masses. So new programming model, by default, it would be fast and it does all the things, the tricks. Out of the box, so you don't have to like do things that we did in Kestrel. So it's on .NET CoreFX Lab, which is our kind of our labs area for doing .NET stuff. And Emo's the PM, so you can ask some questions.
Okay. Is that on the same site as the rest of the .NET Core?
Yeah, so we have CoreFX, which is the mainline repository for the .NET framework, or the .NET Core part, and then CoreFX Lab is essentially our playground where we play with new things. I mean, to me, the coolest thing with pipelines is that if you look at the Tech and Power benchmark, like I think Hanselman said about it, it's the strongest increase Tech and Power has seen with a web framework in terms of performance.
Yeah, I think it's like 894,000 times better.
But I don't think we have maxed out. I mean, we basically basically we fixed a bunch of the, I mean, low hanging fruit may be a bit an overstatement, but we did a bunch of fixes, but we still have massive room to move forward. And pipeline is one of those areas where I think it can make a huge difference. So I don't think we are at the top of our performance abilities yet.
We're going to win. Yes. You heard it here.
Challenge.
Well, you know, it's great when we have competitive people. You want to be number one. You weren't number one yet, right?
Number 10 is so far from number one. I'm just kidding.
You're on the map now.
Yeah, we're
that
there.
Makes it better. You're on the map.
You can see us now. And within a scroll, you can see us. Before it was like.
So are you guys thinking ahead now of new things? Or, I mean, what we announced, you know, VS 2017. RC, you know, not in a core 1.1, and a new framework 1.1, C# 7. What's next?
Always thinking ahead.
I'm not supposed to ask that one, I forgot.
Okay, you're not supposed to ask?
We
are already talking about what's next in C#,
yeah,
and Visual Basic, and it's, I mean, we're soon done with the engineering, so we better have something new for people to work on, or they'll be pulled to other stuff. Right? So,
performance, I guess.
So we're thinking about better tracking of nullability. We're thinking about taking async to the next level,
awesome,
and having async stream work and stuff like that, which might actually gel super well with the pipelines work.
It will.
Yeah, I'd say on the EF side, we're looking at tackling some more features off of our backlog of critical features that people just need in an ORM. At the same time, trying to innovate and make our link provider that translates a link query to SQL, try and make that more efficient and capable of translating more queries. And then at the same time, too, we have an EF6 release that we've said we're going to release minor updates to, and so we're going to follow through on that promise as well.
Okay. I think that's it then. That's a wrap for today. Thanks for joining.
Cool. Thank you, Karen.
Thanks for having us.